I first met Corey Remsburg, a proud Army Ranger, at Omaha Beach on the 65th anniversary of D-Day. Along with some of his fellow Rangers, he walked me through the program and the ceremony. He was a strong, impressive young man. He had an easy manner. He was sharp as a tack. And we joked around and took pictures, and I told him to stay in touch. A few months later, on his 10th deployment, Corey was nearly killed by a massive roadside bomb in Afghanistan. His comrades found him in a canal, face down, underwater, shrapnel in his brain. For months, he lay in a coma. The next time I met him in the hospital, he couldn't speak, could barely move.
President Obama talking about Sergeant Corey Remsburg at last night's State of the Union address. Sergeant Remsburg sat next to the First Lady. He was in full uniform. The president has met him three times, first when he was healthy and then after he was blown up, as he indicated, by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan on his 10th deployment. Jackie Combs wrote about the president's repeated encounters with Corey Remsburg for The New York Times, where she is White House correspondent. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, tell us about that first meeting. He outlined it a little bit in his speech last night, and that was at a ceremony for D-Day?
Right. It was in, the president was in his first year as president, and it was the 65th anniversary that June of the D-Day landings in France. And while the president was there, he met with this elite group of Army Rangers who had reenacted the parachute drops of D-Day, and among them was Sergeant Corey Remsburg. And he took his picture, they joked around like he described last night, and then it was only months later that the president was due to have a physical at Walter Reed Hospital here in just outside Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And as he usually does, he arranged time to visit a few of the wounded warriors there. So he visited five soldiers, and then he said he'd have time for one in the intensive care unit. So he visited five soldiers, went into the intensive care unit, and as he came in the door, he saw a photo on the wall above the bed of himself and this ranger in France. And he looked down at the bed, and he couldn't recognize it. It was the same person. He thought, this can't be. And he went to the bed. Corey had just come out of brain surgery, skull surgery. He had literally, there's a picture that we ran in the paper last August, 100 stitches across his skull.
Mm-hmm.
And he was paralyzed, partially blind, and mute. So the president stood next to his bed and talked to him. And he was able to lift his arm and try to salute. And when the president asked how he was, he clenched his fingers together and gave a thumbs up. And if you saw the State of the Union last night, you'll see that at the end of the speech, the president looked up into the gallery at Corey and gave him a thumbs up. And that was sort of their sign, and Corey gave him a thumbs up back.
Wow. And he has been through dozens of surgeries. He's in daily 8-hour-long rehabilitation right now, and he has made really a remarkable partial recovery. He can actually speak a little bit now and walk a little bit.
Right. And I actually, I've dealt with him and his father by email mostly and phone since last August when I discovered this coincidence of their three meetings, all of which had photos taken. And yesterday when I found out they were in town, I called and I was told what hotel they were at. And we arranged to meet a few hours before Corey and his father had to go to the White House for the trip to the Capitol. And he is just got the best spirit you can imagine. The guy he's so sort of optimistic, full of spirit. He's spent 2.5 years in rehabilitation centers and hospitals. And he knows that this is going to be his fight for the rest of his life to recover, to walk independently, to recover his speech. And he is somebody, and he really embraces this role he's come to have of being sort of the symbol of wounded warriors. There's over 50,000 of them just from Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's come to represent all of them for the commander-in-chief, but for Americans, now for all Americans who have become aware of his story.
Right, right. And really for the president, what you know, you say in your article and you've just said here that these meetings were, or at least two of the three meetings were by chance. So
yeah.
For the president, and this rarely happens, if ever.
Yeah, I have, the White House cannot think of another a wounded warrior whom the president knew or met before his injury, his or her injury.
Right. And so for the president, what is the connection and what does Corey Remsburg mean to him?
Well, he sees what Corey means to him is this man who willingly took on this sacrifice and 10 deployments. Now, granted, these Ranger deployments are shorter than we tend to think of a deployment. It's not a full year each time. But they're very dangerous, each one of them. And so Corey was hurt badly, and he faces a lifetime of recovery. And for the president, this puts a face on it. And for Corey, it's become his sort of occupation, and he is fated all over the country. He gets to do things. You know, it's a small consolation, perhaps, but he and with his father often, because his father is one of his caretakers, is going all over the country biking. He's got a recumbent bike that he's learning, and he gets into races. There was one in Hawaii. He and the president almost saw each other in Hawaii when the president was on vacation because Corey was there for a race. And it's really, it was interesting to me. The president, as public as this has gotten, he tried initially to keep it private, and it was quite by accident. I had gone to a disabled veterans convention covering the president there on a Saturday last August, and I heard him tell the disabled veterans about Corey, and he said, "I talked to you about him 2 years ago. Well, I met him on Tuesday in Arizona, and I wanted to tell you he's doing much better." And I'm listening, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, I was in Phoenix for your speech last Tuesday, and nobody at the White House told me you were going to be having a private meeting with a wounded warrior. So I asked the White House about it, and they said, well, we didn't tell you because he wanted to keep it private. They had known that Corey was finally out of hospitals and rehabilitation centers and was living with his father and stepmother in Phoenix. So they arranged for him to come to the school so the president could see him.
Could meet him again.
Yeah.
Listen, I was a little confused, though, by what the president was trying to say last night with Corey and speaking to the nation. What kind of message was he really sending? Because you could read it a lot of different ways. You could read it that it was a patriotic message.
Mm-hmm.
You could also read it as, look, here is a symbol of the futility of war,
yeah,
and the inanity of it. Or you could read it as almost a symbol of a battered America that is still, against all odds, surviving, although perhaps enduring lasting wounds. And I'm wondering, is what message was he trying to send? And did he even know that he was sending a somewhat confused message to the viewers last night?
Well, I don't think he would have intentionally sent a confused message. And I do think, people can read into this what they will, what they bring to it. I think, what they see in his story is that, he's the resilience that, like Americans, I mean, I think his line was, Corey reminds us that, that America has never come easy. The idea of our freedom, democracy, and even our economic progress that, we've just come through a huge crisis. And so I think his entire presidency, when you think about it, has been defined by the combination of the domestic, the economic crisis and the two wars that he inherited. And so it's been a presidency shaped by efforts both to recover both domestically and internationally. And, Corey sort of is a human metaphor for that. And he is just a great guy. I mean, he gets a lot of support. They were telling me, and it's about Craig Remsburg was telling me, from the Vietnam War era veterans all over the country who are trying to give to the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans what they themselves did not get in their generation.
So there was no feeling then that he was being used in any way as a political prop. I mean, this is an overtly political speech.
Yeah, yes, of course. And, I think speaking solely about the Remsburgs, and since I have have become familiar with them, is they know, and frankly, from my battle last year to get the White House to release to me in the New York Times the photos, because they were trying to be respectful of the privacy of Corey, and because they initially, you know, did not. See, when we go on the road with the president, if he's in a city and he sees wounded warriors, they almost will always tell us he's going to visit privately with some wounded warriors.
Yeah.
But they don't tell you who they are.
So the Remsburgs don't think.
Right. And in this case, they didn't even tell us. They didn't even tell us that he was meeting. And so they have tried, but Corey, he is being used, but he's being, you know, and I saw it again yesterday when I met him in the flesh, that he says it's says it's my honor, and he slapped his chest to be representative of all the wounded warriors.
Jackie Combs, White House reporter for the New York Times, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right, we're going to talk now about what the president didn't spend much time talking about, and that's immigration, and specifically why immigration reform is important to high-tech companies. I'm joined now by Joe Green. He's president of Forward US. It's a Silicon Valley lobbying group co-founded by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, and it was created, right, to push for immigration reform?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we didn't really hear a lot from the president, but let's take a listen to what we did hear last night.
Independent economists say immigration reform will grow our economy and shrink our deficits by almost $1 trillion in the next two decades. And for good reason. When people come here to fulfill their dreams, to study, invent, contribute to our culture, they make our country a more attractive place for businesses to locate and create jobs for everybody. So let's get immigration reform done this year.
Okay, so that was pretty much it in terms of immigration reform in last night's speech. Were you expecting more?
No, you know, we expected the president to reiterate his support for immigration reform. And, you know, I think this is continuing momentum from, you know, last year we had the Senate pass a historic bill. And we're expecting to see Speaker Boehner this week publicly put out a set of principles as to how the Republicans in the House are going to tackle immigration reform.
Right, they're at the Republican retreat for the next 3 days, but they have said that they are not going to push for full immigration reform, full legalization, but more a path to citizenship. They haven't spelled out exactly what they want. But is there something that Silicon Valley is looking for specifically when it comes to immigration reform?
Well, we started Forward.us at the beginning of last year really to push for comprehensive immigration reform. And we're a group to organize the broader tech community around lots of issues that affect the knowledge economy, starting with immigration reform. And for us, you know, comprehensive reform means a path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented immigrants. It also means fixing our legal immigration system to better serve our workforce needs. And it means fixing border enforcement and employer verification.
And to what purpose? Are you looking for high-skilled workers primarily?
No, we started the group because we believe that the situation of the 11 million undocumented immigrants is one of the biggest challenges in our country. And we think that, you know, at a very fundamental level, you know, we're all entrepreneurs, and we think that the entrepreneurial character of the country comes from being a nation of immigrants, that we are the place that those who strive, that those that want a better life come. And we think that's both software engineers and people coming here without an education to work hard for their families.
So the president is saying that, or he did last night, that immigration reform would indeed benefit the economy to maybe $1 trillion. Do you agree with that? And I wonder if you could put a number on it when it comes to your industry and what a lack of immigration reform is costing you.
Yeah, I mean, immigration is clearly a very, very good thing for the American economy. And one of, I think, our key competitive advantages globally that, you know, we are a welcoming culture, a culture with the idea that anybody can come here and become American. You know, in the tech industry, there's a huge shortage of qualified software engineers, and that is forcing companies to open offices in Canada that they would rather have in California. And to us, it just seems crazy that we would, you know, most countries would love to have the most talented, hardworking people from around the world want to come there, and we have that, and our values and our culture allow for it, but our laws don't serve those values.
So are you looking also for more H-1B visas, things like that?
What we think of
the high-skilled workers?
What we think of as, you know, one of those three main parts of comprehensive reform is you have to have an immigration system that actually serves our economy. And that is all, you know, different parts of the workforce, whether that's high-skilled workers or whether that's people working on farms. There's a lot of different American businesses that benefit from having immigrants come and work here. We want to make sure that our legal system allows that to happen.
Now, your organization, Forward.us, I think I said it earlier. I'm sorry about that. So it's FWD.us.
Correct.
It got some flack, a little bit of flack, for sponsoring some conservative messages with regards to slamming Obama's health care law and in favor of the Keystone Oil Pipeline. And what was the reason for that when some of the people in your organization are pretty famously pro-environment, pretty famously left-leaning. Was this a sophisticated way of trying to get conservative lawmakers to your side when it comes to immigration reform? Was that what you were doing with that?
Yeah. So, you know, it's been almost 30 years since the last time we had a big immigration bill in 1986. And when we came and looked at this, what we saw was a challenge that was fundamentally political. Most members of Congress on both sides, we think, fundamentally agree on the policy. 80% of the American people, when polled, agree on this. But there's challenging politics on both sides of the aisle. So we wanted to come in and say, look, let's be pragmatic about this. And we had a strategy of wanting to create political space and political support for members of Congress that kind of go out on a limb and support immigration reform. And, you know, not everyone is going to agree with our tactics.
There's a lot of blowback. I mean, from people who were saying, let's boycott Facebook, people, Sierra Club, Move On, people like that, organizations like that, saying we're not going to buy ads on Facebook because of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, we didn't take this on because it was easy. We took it on because we think it's really important.
Did it work? I mean, did you get lawmakers on your side on this?
I mean, look, we think that, you know, us and many other groups in the coalition have I think, really helped. You know, we got a bill through the U.S. Senate for the first time in almost 30 years. And I think we have a really good shot in 2014 of getting a bill or a set of bills in front of President Obama that he can sign that will solve this really, really important issue.
All right. I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking about this today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Joe Green. He's president of Forward.us. That's a Silicon Valley lobbying group co-founded by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and created to push for mainly immigration reform. The artisanal toast craze. We will get to the bottom of toast next on Press Play.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Madeline Brand, and this is Press Play. Toast. If you think it's just cooked bread, maybe the easiest thing to make in the kitchen, well, think again.
Toast is an amazing culinary wonder that was first created in 1905. It's widely believed that the first electric toaster originated in the United Kingdom, where the Maillard reaction technology was harnessed and commercially produced. From the early days when toast lovers had to rely on toast factories for their weekly delivery, to today's modern miracle where nearly everyone can enjoy this toaster treat, we can only imagine where the future of toasting will take us.
Okay, that of course is a joke from the good people at Funny or Die, but the thing is, the joke is a little bit on them. Toast is now taken very seriously. It is now artisanal, which means it now costs about $4 a slice at fancy cafes. John Gravois wrote about this new foodie craze for the latest issue of Pacific Standard Magazine, and he's on the line now. Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, so there's something about this whole idea that is just obviously absurd, but it is a thing, right?
I think we have to accept it. I think it's a thing.
But you sound very unwilling to accept it as a thing.
Well, I'm very willing to accept it. But I wasn't at first. I you know, it's the kind of new trend that that you greet with a kind of guardedness and you roll your eyes. But when I first started seeing it around San Francisco, I was also, I had that also that feeling that I had just discovered something.
Right, something perhaps important. So it does start in San Francisco. The origin tale of Fancy Toast is San Francisco.
That's what it seems to be. Yeah, I mean, I moved to San Francisco about a year ago, and one day was just in a cafe on my way to work, minding my own business, and I saw this guy making toast very seriously, or taking it very seriously, and then I figured, well, that's just that's the kind of thing that maybe I will run into once in San Francisco. It's a town that gets a little carried away with food. But then I was in another place a couple of weeks later, and I found a place that had a whole toast menu. Then another week after that, I was in another cafe where there was yet another special toast menu, and the whole place was basically devoted to coffee and toast.
And what kind of toast? Is it different breads or different toasting methods that?
Well, yeah, the place that's sort of the biggest font of fancy toast in San Francisco, or the place that was, that probably does the biggest business in toast, is a collaboration between a coffee roaster and a baker. So they look at it as a way to showcase the baker's bread. So they sell all sorts of different kinds of breads, usually but they bake it so that it looks kind of like the Wonder Bread shape. It's a Pullman loaf. It's square shaped, and they'll serve it with a topping that could range from just butter to something like pumpkin butter or.
Right. That sounds actually delicious, I have to say.
It's disarming. It is.
It's disarmingly delicious.
The thing is, I think we have low expectations when it comes to toast. So it's not actually that hard for a somebody to impress you with a slice of especially good toast.
Okay, I want to bring in someone who actually makes the toast here in Los Angeles. Her name is Jessica Coslow, and she runs Squirrel Kitchen in Los Angeles. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, Madeline. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And getting increasingly hungrier. So, what? Tell us why toast.
Why toast for us at Squirrel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little bit similar to what he was saying with Josie, the bread baker, who has his beautiful coffee shop in San Francisco, the Mill. You know, I think. For me, you know, I was a pastry chef. My focus has been preserving for the last 3 years almost. And I was looking for that nostalgia that I had as a child, very similarly to the woman who runs and owns Trouble. That was my breakfast snack, my lunch snack.
This is a cafe in San Francisco that he wrote about.
Yeah, the Mill. But, you know, Josie, he really cares. For the same amount of time that I've been making preserves, he's been really focused on making some extraordinary bread, and he was looking for a place to kind of showcase his talent. And I think it's similarly on this side, where we are at Squirrel, where, you know, we're just trying to find a vehicle to showcase what we do best, which is the preserves.
I see. So it's not about the toast. That's just a conveyance for
the
real deal.
I mean, I think it means something for each place that does it, or I hope it does. You know, for me, it's finding that perfect vehicle to show off what, you know, we're doing. And I think for Josie, it's about the vehicle itself.
Yeah. So what is it about toast? I mean, seriously, it's something a five-year-old could do to make. I mean, it's not that hard.
Yeah. No, I know. You know, I think part of it is that nostalgic quality. Part of it, I think it is the nostalgic. I think it's also the time that we're in. We just kind of reemerged from a low point in economy, and during that point, a lot of us questioned what we wanted to do and started to specialize in those small things. And as a result, you're getting maybe one of those results is a toast movement, where you have different people who are specializing in different things, and they're showing them in a in a similar but different way.
All right. A toast movement. You heard it here. Jessica Coslow runs Squirrel Kitchen in Los Angeles. And we also heard from John Gravois, deputy editor for Pacific Standard Magazine, where you can read all about the new toast foodie craze. Oh, my gosh. Now I'm so hungry. Thank you both of you.
See you soon.
All right. Coming up, we are going to meet the documentary filmmakers behind the new movie, The Square. It's about what has happened in Egypt since the uprising 3 years ago. That's coming up on Press Play. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's been 3 years this month since demonstrations in Tahrir Square brought an end to almost 30 years of dictatorship in Egypt. The country has been in turmoil ever since. First, the army took over. Then Mohamed Morsi was elected Egypt's first Islamist president. Then Morsi was overthrown, and now the army is back in power. Through all of this, filmmaker Jahan Nujaim documented the events as they unfolded. Her film about the ongoing events is called The Square, and it's up for Best Documentary Oscar. I recently had a chance to sit down with Jahan and her producer. Jahan Nujaim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And also producer Karim Amer, who's in the studio as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you originally got this idea to do this film how?
I grew up about 10 minutes away from the square, and my family still lives there. So I've been going back. I went to college in the States, but have been continuing to go back. And so there was no place that I wanted to be more than in the center of Tahrir filming everything that was going on. And I met my crew, and I met Karim pretty soon after I got there.
And Karim, what were you doing there?
Well, so I actually went down in the beginning as a skeptic. Thankfully so, I was completely overwhelmed and sparked by what had, you know, by this electricity that happened in that square.
Relationships are becoming very strong. We're waiting for him to resign tonight.
Less than a month later, Mubarak resigned. He stepped down. And as we see in your film, people are jubilant. And it really is a moment of optimism, excitement, and yet that quickly changes, that quickly evaporates, feeling.
It took 18 days of people staying, sleeping in the square, and Mubarak stepped down after 18 days. But that's really where the story begins. And, you know, so we have him stepping down about 5 minutes into the film. And a lot of people went home. But what we were curious about and wanted to follow were the people that decided to stay in the square, who said that Mubarak stepping down is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we still have a military regime in place. We still have the secret police. We still have the rest of Mubarak's government. And so it's a fairy tale. It's a dream to think that just because he stepped down, the country has changed.
People assumed that it was just a political movement trying to remove Mubarak. The reality is that the demand was very clear from the beginning. It was Shab Yurid Iskat Nizam. The people demand the downfall of the regime. And the regime is not just Mubarak, the regime is not just his peers, the regime is an entire shift of consciousness. It's an entire way of thinking that things are done that need to be completely recalibrated. You know, it's an entire Egypt is a land of, it is the centralized state. You know, it's land of the pharaohs. It is the strong man rule. And that's what people are trying to break. They're trying to give the people a voice for the first time and to have a stake in the changing and the shaping of the country. And what we witnessed in the film was that it's a dedicated few that remain, that are steadfast, and that are unwilling to compromise.
Although what you document, a year and a half later, or maybe 2 years later, when Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood is elected president, the amount of people the footage is extraordinary. The amount of people that came out to protest Mohamed Morsi was, I mean, people were saying that this is maybe the biggest protest ever.
Millions of Egyptians came down to the streets in nationwide protests against President Mohamed Morsi on Sunday, the first anniversary of his term in office.
There's around 20 million people or so that came down in a country of around 80 million plus. So imagine a quarter of the United States in the streets. It was documented at the time as one of the largest protests in human history.
Wow. So now the army is back in charge.
We are going through a very, very dark time right now.
As long as we look at the Egyptian revolution or movement or uprising or whatever people want to call it, on the political continuum only, then I think we're failing to really understand what's happening in Egypt, this idea of revolution. Revolution, how we view it at least, happens on the political frontier, on the social frontier, on the cultural frontier. And I think that it's going to take time to get the results that we all want to see all over the world of Egypt having this kind of secular government that has respect for human rights and has the perfect kind of gender boundaries and this and that. But I think that people are empowered and feel for the first time in Egyptian history that we, the people, have a stake and have an ability to shape our future.
Let's talk about the filmmaking. You follow these two characters, Ahmed and Magdi. Ahmed is your lead character, and he's a secularist.
Well, you know, this is interesting. I mean, he prays, he's religious, he grew up in a religious family, but religion in Egypt to many is a very private thing. It's not something that should be involved in politics, which was what was actually and what will go down in the history books, I think, of that massive outpouring against Morsi was people coming down to the streets basically saying, we want separation of church and state. We want religion out of politics. And Ahmed has always felt that way. And you see that in the film. He says, you know, you need a piece of paper in order to prove that you're Muslim. Come on, you know. And he's getting into this argument with the Muslim Brotherhood. So, yes, we followed Ahmed. We felt like he was very representative of, you know, the person that came down to the streets who would never have called themselves an activist or a protester or really involved in politics, but just came down because he just said enough, you know. There was this feeling in the country that it was kind of either you take my life or you destroy the life of my kids and my grandkids in this future. So I am going to stand and put everything that I have on the line in order to fight for what I believe in. And you fall, I mean, you've seen the film, you fall in love with Ahmed when you meet him. I fell in love with him.
Yeah, he's really charming and just full of life.
Yeah, everybody does.
He's a great character. And then his friend is Magdi, who's of the Muslim Brotherhood, but he comes down, and at the beginning of the film, they are as one, as you say, like it was the spirit of brotherhood, if you will, small b, in the square at that time when they were working together to oust Hosni Mubarak. And then that changes with the election of Mohamed Morsi.
Magdi is a very interesting character because what you see in Magdi is he's been a loyal member of the Muslim Brotherhood for 25 years. He's one of their foot soldiers. And his relationship with the Brotherhood, though, begins to change as the Brotherhood comes into power. He begins to question his relationship with the Brotherhood and what they're telling him to do.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Karim Amer and Jahan Nujaim. They're the filmmakers behind the documentary The Square, which is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. You know, there's a lot of fear for women being in the square. And how did you handle that?
Well, we're shooting with the Canon cameras where you take sound and picture separately. So oftentimes I would be with Karim in the square, or I would have Ahmed, who would manage to pull me out of situations that are unimaginable that he could possibly find me. But I would find his arm and his voice yelling my name and pulling me out of a tear-gassed, crazy situation. But everybody on the team, we had three camera women on the team. We were careful to go down with guys in mm-hmm. when we were shooting. But everybody on the team was either tear gas, arrested, shot at. I was arrested 3 times. And
what were they arresting you for?
Well, this was when I first arrived in the country, and I had in my bag DVDs from my previous film called Egypt, We Are Watching You, which is not the best.
I was going to say.
Not the best title of a film to have in your bag as the country is exploding. And so they took me in. I tried to destroy the DVD because I realized that that's why I was being taken in. By being a woman and saying that I needed to use the restroom urgently, and that I was allowed. If I was a guy, they probably would not have allowed me to do that.
And you took your bag.
And I took my bag and tried to destroy the DVD. I don't know if you've ever tried to break apart a DVD, but it's very difficult. Hard. Went back into the interrogation room, and about 5 minutes later, the guy that was cleaning the bathroom came in holding a piece of the DVD in his hand, waving it in the air, and the interrogators look at me. And at that point, they let me go, but that was really, so that was the first time I'd ever been arrested in Egypt. And the second time was when we were actually at the height of a very big battle between the protesters and the police. And somebody threw a tear gas canister, tear gas everywhere, everything erupts. And so we actually got some fascinating interviews in the next 10 minutes as the tear gas was flying. I was filming them. They were talking as they were shooting. It was a crazy situation. And then we tried to get out.
I mean, mind you, though, I mean, Jahan and Dina, my sister, were the only two women in this entire scene that she's describing. I mean, there was no other women there. It was like everyone was telling everyone to go back. And they, of course, being who they are, were on the front lines. And
was your sister arrested or attacked?
She was detained several times. She was a writer for The New York Times and also a producer for CNN. And she was also attacked very badly once in front of the American embassy. Actually, she was accused of being a spy and was assaulted.
It's that kind of it's that sticking to your principles and continuing to push and push, you know, for change that ultimately ends up, working.
Are you afraid, though, that they will crack down on the people in your film? Ahmed and the others and arrest them or worse?
The people in our film have, you know, been online, been on television, been out there. This film isn't going to be the only thing that has exposed them. I mean, the one person that we just spoke to last night was Megdi, who is, you know, in a very difficult situation right now. And so we are worried about him.
But the ultimate protection is attention. That makes them protected. And that's really part of what the narrative is about this film, is that, you know, we, you know, are trying to get this film out there as widely as possible right now, because what's happening in Egypt right now is an attempt to rewrite history. Mm-hmm. It's an attempt to kind of disregard what's happened by some of the counter-revolution forces. And this film is currently being stopped from being shown in Egypt.
So most people haven't seen it in Egypt?
Well, right now some people are getting USBs and passing it around in underground ways in Cairo. And, you know, it's...
But could people watch it online?
No, it's not online right now. Okay. But there are private screenings that are happening.
Because it's on Netflix.
Yes, but Netflix isn't available in the Middle East, so it's not available yet. And, you know, the release of this film and the success of the film internationally, though, is allowing for the pressure in Egypt to be very difficult for them to keep it blocked. You know, and that's why it's really important it's been amazing for us to see international audiences really connect with the film and understand that this isn't just about Egypt. This is a global struggle. This is about popular movements that are bubbling up all over the place. Today, with the availability of affordable cameras like you see in the film, with everyone documenting things constantly and with access to the internet, we the people have a chance at fighting back, right? We the people have an opportunity at providing an alternative narrative. We the people have an alternative writing our own story. And that's a really important message to people in Egypt and in the film. You know, there's a line when Khaled is showing what we called cinema tahrir, when we set up screens in the middle of the square and started telling the real stories that the state media refused to talk about. And, you know, what he says to the crowd is, only we can tell our stories.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. That's Jahan Nujaim and Karim Amer. They've made the movie The Square. It's a documentary about what's happened in Egypt since the revolution. And you can see it on Netflix. You can see it in theaters. And, yes, it has been nominated for an Academy Award in the documentary category. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right, Warren Olney is here now to give us a little preview of To the Point and what's up in about 15 minutes from now.
We are going to jump off from last night's State of the Union speech, talk about what the president's doing today to reinforce some of the messages that he gave the Congress last night, especially the message that he intends to work with executive orders and get around the Congress if they don't go with his so-called year of action. We'll also talk about the Republicans and immigration reform. That's something that apparently they really have to take seriously. They are going to do it step by step rather than going with some sort of comprehensive plan, but, you know, maybe something will happen.
Right, maybe. Midterm elections.
That's right.
It's a political issue now.
You got it.
All right. We will look forward to that in just about 15 minutes from now. And right before that, on Press Play, we're going to be talking about sustainability. And is Los Angeles really a model for sustainability?
Whoa.
I know.
Good stuff.
One person argues, yes, yes. Someone else says, no way. And we are going to talk to both of them. That is coming up next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, a century ago, William Mulholland opened the Los Angeles Aqueduct and famously declared, there it is, take it. Since then, LA has been tarred as an environmental pariah, sucking water from elsewhere to sustain an exploding population. Plus, it paved the LA River, tore out the red car rail system to build those endless freeways that are now choked with traffic and choking us with smog, some of the world's worst smog. LA has been anything but a model of green sustainability. One recent arrival to the city, though, says that's changing, and he is quite impressed with LA's green endeavors. His name is John Christensen, and he is an adjunct assistant professor, senior researcher, and journalist in residence at UCLA, where he writes about environmental issues. Hi.
Hi.
All right, make your case.
Well, I think LA is on the way to becoming sustainable, making a lot of progress. Do we have farther to go? Yes, we do. We certainly do. But, you know, and LA is doing a good job on water conservation, generally has been doing so for 40 years. While the population has gone up, water use has stayed stable. The individual per capita use of water has gone down over that period of time. We've got making good progress on phasing out coal, bringing in solar, a new ordinance on green cool roofs, 350 miles of bike lanes and bike paths. I rode over to the studio today on some of them. Ciclovia, you know, we're at a point, as Christopher Hawthorne has said in the LA Times, a turning point between two versions of urbanism. One is the car-centered urbanism that's made LA famous. Mm-hmm. The next is for us to determine what it is. And I think we can see that there are a lot of pathways being made to a more sustainable, livable, enjoyable LA that is denser, that is greener, that is healthier.
Okay, so you made your case in a publication called High Country News, and that the tagline for that is for people who care about the West. And you're basically saying we're not there yet, but we're on our way. And then you wrote this article, and then
Emily Green, I can't say it on the air, but you wrote in response to that, I disagree strongly, heartily, with most everything that John wrote.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did.
So you do not think that LA is on this path to greener pastures? Certainly
not in terms of water. I think that the yes, we use less per capita because LA and Southern California generally has done a really great job swapping out toilets for low flow models and that kind of thing. But all you have to do is go outside and see our gutters just running over with irrigation overspill from lawn culture. We have our flood control district going to the Supreme Court, fighting, arguing that it's not responsible for the many lawn fertilizers and chemicals in the runoff because it only does flood control. So we're basically draining our water supply and poisoning the ocean. And I don't see how that gets a good report card. It doesn't for me.
Although, but what you're saying is, like, inside homes and apartments, we're doing an okay job in conserving water. It's outside.
It's outside.
Lawn watering. It's the car washing. It's all that. And there are no real restrictions to that water waste.
There were restrictions, but these were quite badly undermined during the last when they brought in the two-day watering regime. Mm-hmm. Our current mayor was key in undermining that.
And Eric Garcetti?
Yes.
You're a fan of Mayor Garcetti on this issue, John.
Well, I think he's come into office. I think that the 100th anniversary of the LA Aqueduct last fall, the election of Mayor Garcetti, as a historian, we look for kind of periods and turning points. I think, you know, this was a turning point for Los Angeles. We have 8 years, I think, unless Eric Garcetti messes up really badly and doesn't get reelected, to really make some significant changes. He talks about the right things: localizing water, cutting energy use, more efficiency, confronting climate change, providing access to parks.
He restored the LA
River.
Yeah, he took a picture of himself.
He's like the symbol, of a green LA. You know, they've just come out with a framework for a sustainable city plan. They're making progress. You know, could it be faster? Could there be more? Yes. Should we hold his feet to the fire? Yes, I think, we should, to see what happens. But I do think that the right things are being said. The right plans are being put into place.
I disagree completely.
Okay, great. Yeah, I want you to get into that because I just want to point out that you're a newcomer to the city, John. Emily, you've been here for a long time, so
yes.
You're a little more jaundiced.
Yes.
A little more rose-tinted glasses. I don't know.
I'm in the honeymoon phase.
Right.
You're a booster, so go ahead, Emily.
I can remember Antonio Villaraigosa riding in, green, million trees, water conservation. He churned through five water managers and left a desperate mess. Mayor Garcetti has addressed many things to do with water, but not conservation and not reliability. He's very carefully dodged that. He's based his campaign on reform of the DWP financially. He has really not addressed the fact that we are careering into a water shortage that's unprecedented.
Why do you think that is, then? Because we just have to look at the weather report and realize that this is, a crisis situation in California.
Because this is really not going to get him elected. It's not going to make him popular. We have to fix aging water mains. We have to charge a lot more for the water we do use. We have to go for wholesale landscape reform. And we're going to be in scrapping fights with Northern California and farmers in the Central Valley over who gets how much and who pays for new infrastructure. These are going to be bare-knuckled, bloody fights, and they're not, who wouldn't rather pose in a kayak? I mean, this is tough stuff.
It's tough stuff. It's really, really expensive. But are there cities that are doing it and actually taking on this challenge?
Yes, because they have to. California is very well endowed in from the Colorado River and Sacramento, San Joaquin Bay Area, and Owens for LA City, Owens Valley. Whereas if you go across the state line into Nevada, or you go into Arizona or New Mexico, where their supplies are much leaner. They've been buckling down outdoor waste for years now, and the rate hikes have been going up, and the amount of water they get has been going down. And do they love it? No, but they're facing
it. They have to do it.
Well, you could also argue, I mean, that Los Angeles is actually doing a pretty good job of combining conservation with better management of water, and then looking toward those solutions of capturing and storing more stormwater, reusing and recycling water, doing more conservation. So that's where I argue that I think Los Angeles is becoming a model for sustainability.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we didn't even get to the other issues, rail and other issues of sustainability, but water is a big topic, especially these days. I want to thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's Emily Green. She's a freelance reporter and blogs about water issues at chanceofrain.com. And John Christensen, he is a journalist in residence at UCLA and editor of Boom, a Journal of California. All right, here she is, Jolie Myers.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi, you're here with the mail.
I am, and I have to tell you that we are getting a lot of love through our listener email, pressplay@kcrw.com. We'd love to also get a little love or, you know, hate through our voicemail.
No, we don't want hate.
How about ambivalence, maybe? I'll take ambivalence. 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. You can hear yourself on the radio. So earlier in the show, we talked about bougie toast. Yeah. And Facebook completely exploded. No surprise
really?
There.
It doesn't exist anymore. It's not just toast crumbs.
But I found an archive version. And Anna Rose says that unless they're using a toasting fork and a lit fireplace to roast it, then no, she is not going to pay $4 for toast. Yvonne Condis on Twitter wanted to know whether the toast had duck liver mousse on it or something. And I would eat that for the record. Katie Lido on Facebook says that, you know what? We spend $5 on lattes all of the time. Why not $4 on
I know. It's sort of creeping. And can we note that this has been the gluten lover show for the last two days?
We have been gluten evangelists for the last 2 days. I promise that we are not in with the gluten industry. That's our disclaimer.
We are not in. Okay, so Facebook is just find us at KCRW's Press Play. What else? At KCRW Press Play for
at
Twitter.
At KCRW Press Play. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we're live tweeting the show every day.
Excellent. Jolie Myers, thanks for doing that.
Thank you.
Talk to you tomorrow. And really, there's my exit cue. We're out of here. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening. Warren Olney is up next on To The Point. I'll see you tomorrow.